What you read here on the slide is the title of a project where I investigate a treatise written in 13th century Yemen, written by a sultan. And because I don't want to talk all the evening of this sultan, I just give you his name and I introduce him and his biography, his work and so on later, but this helps me in introducing him. I just call him Al-Ashraf Omar. Introduce both things later, but I'm inclined to use the names before. So that's this introduction. What I like to present you today is a quite descriptive talk. When Esther Maria Guggenmos dropped in after my Easter holidays and asked for a title for this talk, I was very busy with investigating a quite strange table that in one way or the other combines the noises animals did or the appearance of animals together with the zodiacal signs, and it was in the beginning really confusing. And I will show you this table later. And then Maria Esther Guggenmos dropped in and fought for a title. And then I thought my idea was, why not using the expertise we have at the IKGF concerning divination and prognostication and so on, and just show you the divinatory and the magical practices Al-Ashraf Omar describes in his treatise, the Tabsira. That's what I'm doing today. So it's non-theoretical thing, just a descriptive one. And I organized it in three parts. First, I will introduce shortly the Sultan and his background, a little bit on his political background, then more information on his treatise, and finally I will just show you the divinatory and magical practices, or most of it, that are preserved in his Tabsira. Al-Ashraf Omar was the third of the Rasulid sultans in Yemen, and so the question is, who were the Rasulids? And I'm sorry, a little bit sorry for this map, I don't have a better one. And on the other hand, it's in German. I'm sorry, but I didn't find a better one for this talk. And the Rasulids came to Yemen in the mid of the 12th century. They were attendants of the Ayyubids. And the Ayyubids, some of them, a member of the Ayyubid family is probably well known to everybody here. This is Saladin, the famous Saladin who fought against the Crusaders and so on. And the Ayyubids came to the Yemen in mid or around 1180, and it was a brother of Saladin who made an attempt to enter the Arabian Peninsula. One reason to go there was there was quite turmoil and quite a bad situation in Mecca that hindered the pilgrimage, especially of the Iraqi pilgrims, to go to Mecca for the annual pilgrimage. And in that way, the brother of Saladin, Tur al-Shah, passed Mecca and Medina and goes to the Yemen. And there he established quite stable rule for over 50 years. And to make a long story short, by the imponderabilities of history, the Rasulids were in the service of the Ayyubids. And when the Ayyubid ruler left the Yemen in the beginning of the 13th century, he established the grandfather of Al-Ashraf Omar as a governor, first of all, but there was never Ayyubid returning to the Yemen. And finally, the Rasulids, in the beginning the just governors, became the sultans of the Yemen, and the Yemen became an independent state for at least 200 years before another dynasty takes over. What is probably quite important, I think, is that the Rasulids are not a local Yemeni dynasty. They came from outside together with the Ayyubids, and they were most probably of Kurd or Turk descendants. And this might be one of the reasons why they were so successful in unifying the Yemen. They were outsiders. And on the other hand, they were probably, because of this outside position, interested in architecture, in promoting architecture, and patronaging the sciences, because it's one possibility to show we are the rulers, we know what we are doing. This is to make a long story short, what the Rasulids were. And the third of their sultans was Al-Ashraf Omar. And he died in 1296, after a very short period of reign. He was only for at least 2 years the Sultan of the Yemen, before he was an emir, or it's called in the sources an emir. And in this time, before coming to the throne, or following his father to the throne, he wrote several scientific treatises and made instruments. And in between these treatises, you found texts on medicine, you found texts on genealogy, texts on agriculture, on veterinary, or better, horse medicine, and three treatises or three works concerning the signs of the stars, concerning astronomy and astrology. This is the Tabsira. Further, he wrote an instrument book, and in the instrument book he describes how to make astrolabes, how to make water clocks, and how to make a magnetic compass to find a direction to Mecca, the Qibla. And at the end of this instrument book, there are two ijazat preserved. These are some sort of approvals by his teachers. And there they say that the Sultan made his astrolabes skillfully and exactly. Correct quote is skillfully and accurately. And it's really a nice windfall of history that one of the astrolabes the Sultan made is still preserved. This is what you see here. This is one of the astrolabes the Sultan made. And it is most probably spoken of in these approvals of his teachers. And this one is nowadays in New York in the Museum of Modern in the Metropolitan Museum. So that's the right thing. So far just a very short introduction on the political situation in the Yemen in the 13th century, and some information what the Sultan did besides of reigning, besides of writing other scientific treatises. And I now want to introduce to you very shortly the Tabsira, his treatise on the signs of the stars. The Tabsira is only preserved, as far as I know at the moment, in a unique copy that is in Oxford in the Bodleian Library. There is unfortunately no date, and it's not signed. And altogether there are 160 folios that makes up 32 pages, and it's almost complete. There's some sheets missing, but not many of them. And just who likes to see it in the beginning. Why I'm talking of signs of the stars. Below the title follows the name of the sun, and you can imagine quite abbreviated name. It's quite too long. And the Tabsira is organized in three main parts. There's a very interesting introduction. This is one thing I wanted to do here, is editing and translating the introduction. There's a table of contents, and altogether 15 chapters, and the information provided is not only written or presented in text, but there are also tables and different schemes. And when you have all, this is a table of content of the taxa where I summarized some of the chapters all together, and it's quite in my opinion, quite an erratic mixture. You have at the beginning a big part on descriptive astrology. Descriptive astrology I like to use to contrast to mathematical astrology. Somebody had distinguishing between horoscopic or non-horoscopic astrology, but I think it's too tied. It's better to think about some sort of descriptive and some sort of mathematic and calculating astrology. For example, in these chapters you find the information on the colors and the planets Herr Herbers talked about, or informations of the association of the planets with plants, with places, with waters, with metals, and such information. And it's quite half of the Tapsira contains this sort of descriptive astrology, and I will later show you some examples of them. Another big part of the Tapsira is contained here in chapters 32, 36 up to the 39. This mainly deals with timekeeping in the year, some calendrical information, an almanac, as it says, and so on. And a third quite big part concerns timekeeping by day and night, and the determination of the Muslim prayer times. And this is mainly preserved here in these summarized of 27 to 30, that summarized with timekeeping. These are the main contents of the Tapsira. There are others, for example, geography, and the symbols and ciphers I will introduce later. So this was my very short introduction on the Sultan who wrote the treatise on the stars, on Al-Ashraf Omar and his Tapsira. And I now wanted to come to the divinatory and magical practices that are described in this treatise. But probably first it's important, if you have any questions concerning the Sultan or his treatise that are more general, it's probably easier to ask now, before I'm coming to the more detailed divinatory practices. Okay.
How do you know this is not complete if it's the only copy from other?
What, for example, there's the end of one chapter missing and the beginning of the next one. The end is missing, I know, because of the table of contents, and the beginning is missing, I know, because it starts, I think, with cancer. So the other zodiacal signs are missing. This is one example. Another one I will show you later. Okay, that's why I'm saying almost complete, because I just discovered these missing pages when I have a very close look on the text. In the beginning, it really, there are no obvious breaks or in the manuscript itself. It looks very complete for the beginning. But when you have a closer look, then you discover there's
any idea why you guys wrote about these matters in this sort of tradition, family tradition perhaps, or is it a customary for American persons to write about
the reason why he wrote this treatise? This is one of the questions.
There is
I hope
no background information.
There is some background information in the introduction. There he says that he writes a treatise as an introduction for beginners in the science of the stars. And this is one of the things I want to do here in Erlangen, to see if this promise he gives in the introduction he really fulfills in the contents. This is one aspect where I'm interested in the text, beside of the information themselves, and of course because we don't have so many sovereigns writing scientific treaties. There are only a few, and most of them are Russell itself. So this is, I think, quite interesting. Okay, then let's come to the divinatory and magical practices. Al-Ashraf Omar does not care with any theory. He just gives the practices he recognizes, he knows. And because, as you probably remember, the table of content is so erratic, so such a mixture of descriptive astrology, some timekeeping, and again some astrology, I decided to organize these divinatory practices by my own. And what I came up is probably not a solid theoretical subdivision, but something very useful for me. I just organized these practices according to the signs Al-Ashraf Omar made use of and which indicates his prognostications. Because I'm mainly a historian of astronomy, I came up with this disorganization. So I subdivided the divinatory practices and the magical ones in these two main categories, sublunar signs and astral signs. And yeah, it's just a try for this talk only to organize the practices Al-Ashraf Omar provides. The artificial signs Al-Ashraf Omar provides are mainly numbers and letters. So in this case, he provides basic information, but only one divinatory practice that is concerned with these, with numbers and letters. The basic information are found in the final two chapters, in chapter 49 and 50. And this, and there he introduces the abjad notation. And I'm not sure if you can see it. This is subdivided in columns. Probably noticed from Greek sources or from Hebrew sources, but it's the same. So he just used this so-called abjad or alphanumerical notation. He just explained it in tables. That's the first thing he does. And the second one is he also introduces the, in Arabic, so-called al-adad al-hindiya, the Indian ciphers. The Arabic scientists use two different systems of writing numbers. Here, of course, please. Sexagesimal system. They wrote the units in decimals and the minutes, as in hours and minutes, in parts of 60. I'm not sure how we organize this table where you relate the numbers and the letters. I just have another look on the. If you're interested, we can have together a look in the manuscript how we organize it. Okay. And after the abjad notation, he also introduces these Indo-Arabic ciphers, which are the basis of our modern Arabic numbers, that came from India to the Arabic Islamic religion. I'm not sure if you can read it. I'm sorry, I don't have very good copies of the manuscripts at all. What he's doing here is he starts here with the numerals 6 and the lower sign for 6. He introduces in the final letter, so he provides basic information that can be used for numerological purposes if you want. And the Indian ciphers he uses in chapter 14, where he provides 8 magic squares. And this is the square, the 3 or 4 squares that you might see in the manuscript. This one. Why it's 8 squares? It's quite easy to explain because he associates every square, the 3 to 3, to up to the 8 to 8 square. No, it's more, sorry. The 3 to 3 to the 10 to 10 squares to the planets. And the fixed stars. I mean, primo in astronomy, there are only the five planets known that you can see with the naked eye. It's up to Saturn. So you have Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, five planets. And the Moon and the Sun are also planets in pre-modern astronomy and astrology. So we have seven. And the eighth square, he associates with the fixed stars, with the sphere of the fixed stars. And what I think is probably quite interesting, the 3-3 square, this is an enlargement from the manuscript that he had written in the modern Arabic numbers, where here the Indo-Arabic cycles are used, and he associates with the Moon. This is something that is quite uncommon, because usually the 3-3 square is associated with Saturn. And this has quite a nice explanation. But this explanation is most probably invented later, after the association. And it works the following. The Arabic word for Saturn is Sohal. And the letter Say, as I said in the where I explained the Abjad notation, equals seven. This is what Ashraf Umar also explains in this text. The Ha equals eight. And the last letter here equals three. And if you sum up, the 3-3 square is associated with Saturn, but Al Ashraf Omar makes it the other way around. He started with the Moon, and associates the 3-3 square with the Moon. And this is, there I'm just speculating, but probably this points to a quite early source that Al Ashraf Omar used here, because he has this other association. And I'm quite sure that the explanation comes later. Okay, so. And there's only one, so this is more magical purpose of numbers here. There's only one other divinatory practice mentioned in the Tabsira that is called in the headline of the 41st chapter on the statement of the victor and the vanquished. The problem is, in this case, we only have the information in the table of contents, the text itself is missing. So I'm not sure what is hidden behind this victor and vanquished whatsoever. I just have two ideas. The first one is related to a divinatory practice that makes use of the names of two combats or the two people involved in a struggle. Then it adapts specific techniques of calculating and get up a number value, and then the numbers say if which one is winning and which one is losing. And this is something that is based on Greek sources, and according to my information, this found in a pseudo-Aristotelian text that is called the Book on the Knowledge of the Victor and the Vanquished, and it should be, but I didn't have the time to check this information, should be in the Siral Isra, the Secretum Secretorum too. But this is something I still have to check if it's there. And of course it's just speculation because I only have the headline. And there's, to make it complete, I have another idea what is hidden behind this statement on the Victor and the Vanquished that goes back to Al-Biruni, the famous polymath of the 10th, 11th century. And in his introduction to astrology in the Tafhim, he describes very shortly a magical procedure that secures victory in gambling. So it's quite different. It's nothing has to do with struggle and war and so on, but it has to do with gambling. This might be another other possible explanation, but because I already have the headline, this is the end of the story. And this is this is what I have found in the Tabsira till now in artificial science concerning numbers and letters. So in this same chapter, in the 41st chapter, the first part is preserved and it deals with convulsions of the human body. Al Ashraf Umar provides there six lists of palmomancy that interpret the spontaneous pulsations, tremblings or convulsions of the human body, in particular in the limbs, the eyelids and the eyebrows. And he provides this information in quite neatly arranged and properly written tables. This is just an example. And he subdivides this table or this list, the third suite of lists, into two parts, the left and the right hand side of the body and the left hand side. And then he provides a part of the body that is trembling and the low some to then indicates. Just to give you a better idea, I just started an translation of this upper part here, this line. So it associates with the concerning the right part of the body. If the head is trembling completely, it indicates richness and luck. If it's only part of the head, it indicates prosperity. If it's the front, injustice. And so it goes on through every part of the human body from the top to the feet. Okay, it's just what I found. And Al-Ashraf Umar attributes this list to scholars from Persia, scholars from Byzantium, and to Daniel. And it seems that all these treatises on palmomantic in Arabic sources go back in one way or the other to pseudo-epigraphic texts attributed to Melampos, the Greek soothsayer and healer. But there are two big differences between the Arabic informations and information in the Greek information. That is an omitted individuality. Al-Ashraf Omar says only if the head completely comes or crumbles, it indicates richness and luck. In the Greek sources, there seems to be something like if the head completely convulses or trembles, it indicates for the slave joy and freedom, for the virgin blame, for the widow something beautiful and lasting of her widowhood. So it's a difference between the Arabic sources and the Greek ones. The Greek add information on the person specificate the indications according to the persons. And there's another difference between the Arabic sources and other Arabic sources and Al-Ashraf Omar. In the other sources, there are the part of the body mentioned that convulses, and then several opinions given. For example, I have here one example that says, again, convulsion of the right part of the head. The scholars of Persia say joy after grief. The scholars of Byzantium say traveling and enjoying, and so on. So they add all opinions below one body part. And then Al-Ashraf Omar makes something different. He provides tables for each of his sources. He has lists for the scholars of Byzantium, he has lists for the Persians, and so on. And this is probably an idea, what I said earlier, that he claims to write an introduction into astrology and astronomy, but probably such tables are easier for a beginner than a convolute of texts or information together, but this is just an idea. And there's another table that also takes into account natural and organic science, but this one I will introduce later because it's more complex. It has more than this one dimension where one trembling part of the body indicates one thing. And in the chapter 34, Al-Ashraf Omar mainly provides natural and inorganic science. It comprises the falling of shooting stars, the rainbow, and the encircling hall of the moon. The problem here is a little bit that the headline given in the table of contents is differently organized than the text itself. So I'm starting with the rainbow. And the information on the rainbow are quite preserved in a text, just plain text. And it's organized according to the Byzantine year or the Byzantine month. This is one of the solar calendars used in pre-modern Arabic Islamic societies. I just gave you here an example. This is the Byzantine or Syrian calendar. that goes more or less parallel to the Julian calendar, and it starts in October, and this is probably quite easy to show, because you have October, November, December, January, just another names, and another beginning of the year, but in the length of the year is quite similar to the, is similar to the Julian year. And Balashav Kumar now presents information. He organized the text according to the 12 months, and then he says, if the rainbow is seen in this month, Tishrei Nal Awal, it indicates something. In this case, a year that will be abundant, and troops will spread from east to west. And he goes on for every 12 months. So it's a quite easy, organized divinatory practice. He gives a protasis, and then the upper doses follows. And the same he's doing for the shooting stars, but this time not arranged in a text, but in a scheme. He organized the, in this case, not for the Byzantine months, but for the zodiacal signs, similar informations. Each such art probably gives the same information on the rainbow. And I have an example here too, just that you get an idea what I'm talking about. The text is slightly different, but it again has the same if-then structure. If the shooting stars fall from the zodiacal sign, in this case of Aries, it indicates auspiciousness of Byzantium and Babylon, death and fierce killing. And so he goes around 6 months here and 6 months on the opposite pages. It was again a very close and instrumental divinatory practice, what he provides here. The third one, again, concerns the hull of the sun. And again, it's not arranged in a text, but in a scheme. But again, we have the same if-then structure of the sentences. It's kind of provided in these triangles, let's say. And there's evidence that there, in between the two schemes, one complete folio is missing. Most probably the part on the right side concerns the hull of the moon for the 6 initial months of the Byzantine year. And the scheme on the left-hand side provides the information for the hull of the moon for the final 6 months of the year. So the information concerning the hull of the sun in the final 6 months, the beginning, and the hull of the moon of the beginning 6 months are missing. So one page is most probably missing in between. Okay, so yeah, and this is one of the cases what I'm talking about where it's difficult to see that there's something is missing. Yeah, it just become clear when you have a very close look on the information given. And I did a first preliminary check where Ashraf Kumar provides this information. This is again the one for the hull of the sun. It's the same structure. Again, you have this if. If the halo is seen, then it indicates that and that and that. Okay? And I did a first research where Al-Ashraf Umar gets this information of this chapter and came up with a treatise translated by Alexander Fodor around 75-74 that where he presents a translation of the Malhamad of Daniel. But the Malhamad of Daniel, this prognostication of Daniel, is in the Arabic tradition, as far as I know, quite a vast conglomerate of texts and versions and so on. And what Fodor provided in the 70s is a translation into English and the facsimile of a booklet he found in Iraq in his time. And in this booklet, what he presents as a facsimile, there's only the rainbow and the hull of the sun, the moon discussed. The section, the shooting stars, is not there. And the information given, besides of the organization according to the Byzantine months, are also different. But there is something like that. Yeah, please. It has to do with the Daniel Apocalypse in some way or the other. But it's really a huge topic and a lot of versions, and probably Ms. Sarah knows more about it than I do. No? It's a whole tradition of pseudo-epigraphic treatises related to Daniel. And they provide especially these divinatory practices where rainbows indicates, the seeing of the rainbow indicates specific, let's say specific events and so on. And but I'm not sure how trustworthy these facsimile is. The photo provides in the 70s, because I didn't have the time yet to go closer to the manuscripts to see if I find more information. What I have at the moment is the pseudo Daniel provides is really similar to that, besides of the shooting star which I'm missing, but that's it. Yeah, and it's definitely not the source of Al-Ashraf Oman. It's it's the same structure, the same idea, but that's it. It's not the same. It's not his source, I think. Okay. I have to look on the time. And this is more or less what I have on these sublunar signs in the Tabsira. And now I'm coming a little bit shorter to the astral signs. Subdivided the astral signs there quite nicely into sun, moon, and planets, but this does not work, of course. But what is correct with this subdivision is that Al-Ashraf Umar does not provide divinatory practices related to the fixed stars. This I didn't found yet. What he provides is weather forecasting, astrological weather forecasting. This is a topic I'm not very far with. I just can say that the signs that are provided in this weather forecasting are much more detailed than all the signs used in the sublunar signs. Yeah? For example, for the sign he uses the altitude of the sun above the horizon. He uses the ecliptic longitude of this of the sun and information on the position of Venus and Mercury. So he has at least information here, the highest position of the sun, its degree in Taurus, and Mercury in Venus. It's quite a more elaborated sign than all these sublunar signs shown before. And then he gives some information on the strengthening or diminishing of rain. And it's quite interesting. In this part, he mentioned his sources. In the first part, in Naubacht, which has to be a predecessor of one of the Naubacht who cast the horoscope for the founding of Baghdad. It should be one of the family, probably Al-Fadl ibn Abi Sahla ibn Naubacht. And ibn Naubacht is shortly before Al-Kindi. And for Al-Kindi, we are quite lucky because Boson Burnett published in 2000 his treatises in Arabic and Latin on astrological weather prognostication. And when having a look on Al-Ashraf Umar's text, it looks like what Al-Kindi provides, but again, it's a similar problem to the Malhama of Daniel. It is the same tradition, but it's not its proper source. But in this case, I just started with the research on the topic. It's not a big field of text to check. And what is quite interesting, and this is just something I can mention because I didn't have done anything on it, is there's a second part of the chapter, and this talks about indications of high and low prices, about the movement of prices. And it's attributed to the same authorities, to Ibn Naubacht and Al-Saimari. And by the way, Al-Saimari was a chester at the Abbasid court in the 9th century, sorry. Just to show you, there's something else together with the weather forecasting movement of prices. And the big part, the final big part concerning sun, moon, and the planets are the election astrology. And elections, as the name probably says, concerns electing or choosing the appropriate time to start an venture or an activity. And it's quite a common practice in astrology, at the latest since Greek antiquity, and it doesn't have a high esteem, is this the right word? So it doesn't have a high esteem. And again, because I'm a historian of astronomy, I'm sorry, I organize these elections that Ashaf Umar provides according to the astronomical parameters. First of all, he provides zodiacal elections. This means, for example, if the moon enters the sign of Aries, then it indicates. Okay? And something like that is preserved in the Orpheus Common Astrologicum. Again, with the same problem, it's similar to what Al-Ashraf Umar provides, but it's not a source. Okay? And this is another part where I just started working on. So I don't have any translation of it. It's just if the moon enters this zodiacal sign, it indicates that, and so on and so on. And where I have more information, I did more what I call synodical elections that describe the time by the phases of the moon. And in the example in the Tapsira, it looks like this. It's just a list. Just to give you an example, what Ashraf Umar is doing here, he says the first day of the lunar month, when the moon is a crescent, bloodletting causes headaches, and it goes on. And the second day, it causes freckles. And the third day, it causes that, and so on. And then when we come to the second part of the month, when the moon is waning, bloodletting no longer causes disease, but stops disease. And it's when I first saw this list, I thought, okay, this is standard. It's quite usual. But when I have a closer look, I ended up with one small note in secondary literature that a scholar that wrote in 11th century Egypt about medicine and philosophy, Ibn Butlan, says something about the relations of bloodletting and the lunar phases. But it's all I find until now. But more probably I was looking in the wrong places. So this is these synodic elections, as I'd baptized them. And the third part, Ashraf Umar provides a lunar elections. And in this case, it goes the following. The moon enters one of the lunar mansions. In the zodiacal elections here, the moon enters one of the zodiacal signs. And in the lunar elections, the moon enters one of the lunar mansions. And the lunar mansions are 28 subdivisions of the ecliptic of the parent path of the sun around the earth. They came from India, are related to the nakshatras, but there was a mixture with the Anwar tradition in Arabic, in indigenous Arabic, not indigenous Arabic knowledge. And they came together, let's say. And finally, we have these lunar mansions as known from the pre-modern Arabic sources.
28, yes.
Where the Indians use 27, mostly.
Chinese
use 28. Oh, you have to explain it to me later.
Oh, what
a pity. It's 28. This is the so-called Anwar system. It's a relation of the rising and settings of specific stars and groups of stars with wind, heat, cold weather, and so on. And it's still a little bit vague, let's say. It seems that there was Indian influence, these nakshatras, and they combined in one way or the other with this Anwar system. What comes up in the end is the lunar mansions as we know them from the Arabic sources today. So there are several investigations on it if you're interested, in several articles published by mainly by Daniel Morisco. So if you want more information, just ask me, okay? Okay, these are 28. In this case, I have a translation, so that makes probably easier to understand what I'm talking about. It's again in a text, not in a scheme or in a table. And it says, for example, if the moon stations in Asharatana, Asharatana is the first lunar mansion, then make champs for friendship and love. Do not wear new clothing, and goes on with several advice at what to do and what not to do during this time. And in this case, it's quite interesting that you find this information also in one of the more famous Arabic astrologers in Ibn Abi Rijal's Introduction into Astrology. He also provides these lunar mansions as in the as signs for elections. So he has these lunar elections too, but it is the only one, as far as I know. It's, for example, not mentioned in Kushia or in Al-Biruni or other of the more famous Arabic astrologers. And I know another example of these lunar elections. It appears in a quite completely different genre of text that written by an Ibn Rahiq, the name is not that important, but written in the 11th century Hejaz, the region around Mecca and Medina. And he, in the first part of his books, he just deals with the determination of the Muslim prayer times, the determination of the Qibla, the direction towards Mecca. But in the second part, he has something like an almanac, and also included these lunar elections. But he drops everything that has to do with making charms and has to do with magic. So, and again, it's a similar problem. There is a tradition that Al-Ashraf Umar relies on, but I didn't have the source yet. So it's different, but it's, yeah. And for the final two, I just a little bit inelegant summarized Miscellanea. The first one is the table I talked about in the beginning, the one I was busy with when Esther Maria Gugumos asked me to prepare this talk, or to provide her with a title first. And I don't even have a proper name for it. Therefore, I have tables of mixed signs. And I don't have a translation of it, but I probably can show you it at the original. It's just one of these tables. And in this time, it's really a table because it's not having a column where it's given a date or an astral sign. Another one that associates with the disease, for example, as in the synodic elections. This time, you combine two information to get your to get what it indicates.
It provides you in the
hearing or crying of a magpie, or how do we say in English, wing of a horse, if you have a horse makes noise. And such information are given in this clothes and similar things. And again, I'm sorry I don't have a translation yet, because this is really difficult, because you just have short words without any context, and it's quite a nightmare to translate, to be honest. This is one of these miscellanea, and I think it's important that it's a big difference to the other divinatory practices I've shown, because the others all have this more or less this if-then structure. Yeah? Even if it's a table just in the synodic elections, where you have a day and then the information on bloodletting, it's just this one way, one dimension. But in this case, you have two. You have two informations to combine. I think this is quite a difference. And the final example I want to show you is the seating arrangements. They promised to give an answer to the question, how do you approach to a sovereign to win him over for your own affairs? Well, I think this is quite interesting. And to introduce this in detail, we need another half an hour, and I think this is not, there's not enough time for it, just to give you some information on it. These are the schemes as found in the manuscript, but they had the slogan because they are on the back and the front page, they are not opposite pages in the manuscripts. Although they belong together, and there is a connecting headline in it. And just to give you a rude idea of what is going on, here in the middle you have either the council or the sovereign city, then you have directions. Described on the scheme, and the planets and the lunar nodes associated to these cardinal directions. And then in these half circles here, again, this if-then information, but this time related to the cardinal directions and the planets, so it's even more complex or does have more dimensions than the table of the mixed sign I've shown before. And just to give you an idea, in the first scheme, there is the protasis. If the lord of the council is sitting in this or that direction, then the one who enters and what brings him here shall approach from this or that direction. This is in the first scheme. And the second one, it's a little bit different. There the protasis says, if the ruler wants this or that, then he shall approach the council from this or that direction. And this is, I think, the most complex divinatory practices that Al-Shaf Omar provides in his Tabsira, and the final one I want to show you today. Al-Shaf Omar provides a quite broad variety of divinatory practices in his Tabsira, has the title Treatise on the Signs of the Stars, and he demonstrates, I think, clearly that he's well acquainted with the traditions, for I'm not able until now to find his proper sources. And the combination he's doing of the topics is quite specific, and probably he creates his own genre of treatise on the science of the stars in this case. And what is probably also interesting, according to Emily Savage Smith, in her Magic and Divination she published in 2004, she says that in this time, in the 13th century, divinatory and magical procedures and techniques just start to become well-defined. So it seems that Al-Ashraf Omar is a quite early example, according to what we know at the moment. And then I thank you, Mary.